You are listening to KBOO FM in Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned.
KBOO FM, Portland. Power to people.
Would you like to help KBOO Community Radio grow and prosper? Do you have an interest in nonprofit finances and operations? We have a job opening for finance coordinator. This is a 30-hour per week position with full benefits, including medical. Starting pay is $18 to $22 per hour. You will work with staff, volunteers, and CPAs to support KBOO through account management, financial analysis, and reporting. For a full description, please visit kboo.fm/employment. Resume, cover letter, and application are required. If you have any questions, please email Station Manager Arthur Davis at manager@kboo.org. The deadline for applications is Friday, March 20th, 5 p.m. We look forward to hearing from you.
I'm Lena Alialoro.
This is Scott Fain.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nave.
I'm Robert Barncourt.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Chris Andrea talks with the chief economist from the Senate Banking Committee about the AIG scandal.
Portland's police chief meets with the city council to discuss merging precincts.
And the U.S. finally signs a U.N. statement calling for the worldwide decriminalization of homosexuality.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, March 18th, 2009. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Despite widespread opposition from groups around Oregon, three proposed liquefied natural gas terminals are moving forward in different parts of Oregon. Amy Hardwood of the environmental group BARC spoke at today's city council meeting in Portland, urging the council members to pass a resolution opposing the terminals.
Right now, there's a proposal to build three liquefied natural gas terminals and over 600 miles of pipeline in Oregon. This imported fossil fuel not only continues our dependency on a foreign energy source with an enormous carbon footprint, but also brings a long list of safety concerns to the affected communities and impacts almost every resource-dependent industry we still have in Oregon: fishermen, foresters, farmers, and even vintners. The Palomar Pipeline is proposed to cross Mount Hood National Forest, clear-cutting a highway-width corridor through old-growth forest, wild rivers, and over some of the most famous hiking trails, including the Pacific Crest Trail. So why am I asking the Portland City Council to get involved? Well, I've been working with the affected communities for about 2 years now, and they thought they just needed to get their local leaders to help. So they did that in towns such as Molalla and Forest Grove. All along the proposed pipelines have passed resolutions against this development, including the Clackamas County Commission. But it didn't work. And then they went to the state, and the Oregon Department of Energy said, no, Oregon doesn't need this development. And that hasn't worked either. And indeed, when we found out that major environmental laws would have to be changed in Mount Hood, we went to senators, and indeed, Senator Wyden wrote stating the proposed Palomar pipeline through sensitive and treasured areas in Mount Hood National Forest is unacceptable. And still the gas companies have not changed their scheduled construction. Despite this diverse group of people speaking resolutely with one voice, there's only one voice that is loud enough to make energy companies listen, and that is the consumer. The five of you represent the largest consumer base that the gas companies claim to be serving. Mayor Adams, in your State of the City address 2 weeks ago, you called Portland a living laboratory of sustainability. Well, I am here today to say if this is true, we absolutely cannot allow it to be at the expense of our rural neighbors. I have the great fortune of spending my workday advocating for the forests and rivers of Mount Hood National Forest. And for the past year, BARC has gone door to door talking to Portlanders about the Palomar pipeline that threatens our backyard. And so many of them have asked us, what can I do? So for the past 2 weeks, we've asked them to sign a card to you about this resolution. I'm here today as a resident of this city, backed by more than 300 other residents, asking you to please pass a resolution in opposition to this destructive development and say no to LNG development in Oregon. I'll leave a copy of a draft of this resolution for each of you in your offices as I leave today, and I really hope that you'll contact me with questions, and I thank you again for allowing me to speak today.
That was Amy Harwood of the Oregon Environmental Group, BARC. Governor Ted Kulongoski has spoken out against the proposed gas terminals, and environmental regulations have delayed the project, but gas companies continue to push forward with plans to construct the terminals for foreign imports of liquefied natural gas.
Portland Police Chief Rosie Sizer has unveiled her plan to cut the police budget to the City Council. Sizer plans to consolidate Portland's 5 current precincts into 3, combining the Northeast District with the North and merging the Southeast District with the Central. This move will cost the department 34 jobs, 21 of which are sworn police officers. The police bureau claims the streamlining of the precincts will save the city over $3.5 million, the equivalent of approximately 55 officers. But when Chief Sizer met with the city council, they were skeptical of her plan. Commissioner Randy Leonard wants the department to use existing funds set aside for new officer hires to help balance the budget. Commissioner Nick Fish also wants to slow the process, at least until the committee has more time to weigh the policy impacts of the move.
A proposed bill would allow cyclists in Oregon to legally run stop signs. The bill would make it legal for cyclists to slow down to an acceptable speed instead of stopping at stop signs if the intersection is clear. State Representative Jules Bailey from Southeast Portland proposed the bill. He put the bill forward because he believes bicycles are fundamentally different than cars. Other supporters of the bill say it would help the flow of traffic and help provide a smooth commute. A representative from the Portland Police Bureau says if the bill were to pass, it would most likely be unsafe for pedestrians, drivers, and other cyclists.
1 out of 7 Oregonians is now over age 65, and soon that number will be 1 in 5. So experts say it's worth asking who's going to take care of you when you're older, and who's going to pay for it. Brendan Grubb, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, explains.
More than 40% of Oregonians are caring for an aging family member, or say they will be, within the next decade. Providing and paying for that care isn't easy, especially since so many people haven't saved enough for retirement. AARP Oregon Director Jerry Cohen says cutbacks in state services and programs now are making it even more critical to plan ahead.
It will increase the pressure on families who are, for the most part, the biggest contributor in terms of both time, value of time, and money when it comes to home and community-based care in Oregon.
Margaret Neal, who heads the Institute on Aging at Portland State University, says most people assume Medicare will kick in if they can't afford care, but that is not the case.
It's not just Medicare that doesn't pay for long-term care. Our regular health insurance plans do not cover assisted living, in-home services, or nursing home care, and people think they do.
This month and next, AARP and community groups are holding a series of public forums around the state with panels of experts to discuss long-term care options and common misconceptions. The next ones are in Salem on March 14th and Medford on March 31st. This is Brendan Grubb in conjunction with the Oregon News Service reporting for KBOO Evening News.
Government scientists blame last year's collapse in salmon returning to California's Sacramento River primarily on climatic conditions that produced little food in the ocean and on declining habitat in rivers. NOAA Fisheries Service warned in a report today that there is little that federal fisheries managers can do directly to prevent the boom and bust cycle among salmon. The problem is the lack of genetic diversity brought about by an over-reliance on hatcheries and the increasing frequency of swings in ocean conditions. The federal agency suggested authorities support the difficult long-term steps of rebuilding habitat in rivers and reforming practices in hatcheries. This would restore the genetic diversity that has allowed salmon to survive a changing environment for thousands of years.
Economists, the government, and the American people are outraged at AIG's decision to spend bailout money on retention bonuses for their top executives. But no one seems to know what exactly should be done about getting the money back. KBOO's Chris Andre sat down with Robert Johnson, chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee, to discuss the government's options in detail.
Talk, if you would, a bit about the Paulson Doctrine and the AIG bonuses scandal. Let's just call it a scandal. That's what it is.
Well, regarding Paulson, what my co-author Tom Ferguson and I had been writing is that with the Republicans in power, and with a certain fear of the electorate in the event that they did large bailouts, They tried to do a very indirect bailout using the housing finance system, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, and the Federal Home Loan Bank system, to buy assets from the Wall Street firms and from the private markets at large to take bad assets off the books of the banks in a way that the public would only belatedly recognize, belatedly meaning after the presidential election. In fact, things came to a head before the election.
The so-called sanctity of contracts supposedly makes it impossible for the government to have any recourse. These bonuses are written in stone and there's no turning back. How accurate is that?
Well, I'm a little bit skeptical. In the simplest terms, Secretary Geithner and Lawrence Summers from the White House both sit on the commission for restructuring the auto industry. And I will guarantee you that neither of them invokes the sanctity of contracts when they talk to UAW workers about rescheduling their benefits, their wages, and their pension plans. You have retired auto workers from the city of Detroit who are being told they have to take smaller pensions now so that the auto companies don't go bankrupt. And those are contracts that are just as valid as the bonus contracts for the people at AIG. But somehow we're supposed to honor the AIG sanctity of contract and restructure the auto workers' contract. Secondly, with regard to what are called retention bonuses, the idea of bonus implies some kind of performance. And the idea of retention implies that they need you to stay on and want you to stay on. Well, Andrew Cuomo last night, the Attorney General of New York, revealed that 11 retention bonuses were paid to people who have already left the firm. So there was nothing to do with retention, and obviously a company that's lost $160 billion and counting in the last year, it's hard to configure why a bonus would be necessary. I believe if the government wanted to stop these contracts or claw back these contracts, that they could. And the only hesitance I would have if I were the Treasury Secretary or working in the White House is that I think there are even bigger problems and bigger questions that need to be addressed to protect the taxpayers. AIG's bailout of Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, Societe Generale, a French bank, and others is on the scale of billions of dollars, and I would rather that the Congress would focus its fury on the structure of those bailouts of the big financial firms than focus on the nuance of bonuses, where even $160 million is very unfair, but it's small scale compared to the billions that are being handed to the big institutions.
That was Chris Andre interviewing Robert Johnson. Robert Johnson is a former managing director at Soros Funds Managing and chief economist of the Senate Banking Committee. He has recently written a book about the global financial crisis called Too Big to Bail. An Oregon man who complained about a debt collector garnishing his wages after he had repaid a student loan has won a federal court ruling. The 9th U.S. City Court of Appeals today overturned a lower court ruling against Jeffrey Rowe, who took out a $2,500 loan in Jackson County. The loan was guaranteed by the Oregon State Scholarship Commission, which handed off the debt to Educational Credit Management Corporation after Rowe defaulted. Rowe sued the Minnesota company after it kept garnishing his paychecks until November 2005, when he had already repaid his loan in full in July 2005. The appeals court rejected the company's argument that it was acting on behalf of the U.S. Department of Education and not solely as a debt collector.
The Federal Reserve announced today that it will inject about $1 trillion into the economy in a bold effort to help the battered housing market and lift the country out of recession. At the same time, the Fed left a key short-term banking lending rate at a record low of between 0 and 0.25%. Economists predict the Fed will hold the rate at that zone for the rest of the year and for most, if not all, of next year. In a new program, the Fed said it will buy up to $300 billion of long-term bonds, a move that should boost Treasury prices and drive down rates. That would ripple through and lower rates on other kinds of debt. The last time the Fed set out to influence long-term interest rates was during the 1960s.
Attorney General Eric Holder has signaled a change in policy on medical marijuana. The nation's top law enforcement officer has told reporters that federal agents will target marijuana distributors that violate both federal and state law. This represents a departure from the Bush administration's policy, which targeted medical marijuana dispensaries in California, even if they complied with that state's law. In the conversation, Holder did not spell out exactly who would no longer face the prospects of raids by the Drug Enforcement Administration. But he says cases in which pot dispensaries were believed to be adhering to California law were not a priority of the new Obama administration.
Today in Iraq, a roadside bomb killed a man and his wife when it blew up their car in the town of Sadia, 90 miles northeast of Baghdad. Also, in eastern Mosul, a suicide car bomber attacked a police patrol, killing one policeman and seriously wounding two others.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. The exact number of civilians killed is unknown, since neither the U.S. nor Iraqi governments do body counts of civilian casualties in the conflict. You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Circle A Radio with KABU's Youth Collective at 6. Tonight's show is on resistance and activism. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy all day with a high of 57.
The time is 5:16, and now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Should the government require us to carry a national ID card embedded with what amounts to a barcode containing everything from our Social Security numbers to our commercial transactions? Should the personal data on these cards be stored on various federal and state databases? Should our digitalized identities be subject to use and sale by commercial ID vendors? Holy George Orwell, you might shout. Of course not. Well, don't look now, but a little notice provision was slipped into a war spending bill in 2005, creating something called Real ID, authorizing all of the above. It was rushed into law, as so many liberty-busting Orwellian schemes have been, on the pretense that high-tech ID cards would thwart foreign terrorists. But wait, the 9/11 crash bombers did not sneak into America. They had legitimate work visas and driver's licenses. The massive microchipping of America by the Real ID program is not meant to frustrate terrorists, but us. To open a bank account, board a plane, or enter a government building, show your card. Indeed, the law says that Real ID can be required for anything that the head of Homeland Security unilaterally decrees to be a, quote, official purpose. The good news is that 25 states have opted out of applying the Real ID law to their citizens. The bad news is that the supervision authorities have rebranded it with a less 1984-ish name, Enhanced Driver's License. They're trying to get every state to require that America's 245 million drivers must get these EDLs, which would embody the same abuses as Real ID. This is Jim Hightower saying, this technological intrusion is being opposed by groups from all across America's political spectrum. To join the rebellion, go to ACLU's Real Nightmare website, realnightmare.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go With the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
And now we go to Linda Olson Osterlin with the latest installment of the weekly KABU feature, Civil Liberties Watch.
Welcome to Civil Liberties Watch, a feature of the KABU Evening News. I'm Linda Olson Osterlin. On February 24th, the United States Supreme Court handed down a ruling that has sent rumblings throughout Indian country, threatening to destabilize a significant number of tribes in the years to come. The case was Carceri versus Salazar. Rhode Island Governor Donald Carceri challenged the Secretary of the Interior's authority to take land into trust for tribes that were not already recognized when the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act took effect. The court's ruling revolves around a 31-acre piece of land in Charlestown, Rhode Island, purchased by the Narragansett tribe in 1991. In 1998, the Interior Department took the land into trust, removing it from state jurisdiction and opening the way to development by the tribe. Initially, the tribe built housing for the elderly, but the town and the state feared a casino was planned and sued in federal court. This particular piece of land is just a small part of the land that had been taken from the tribe in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. The Narragansett, who had lived in the area from before the invasion of Europeans, had lost almost all of their land by the mid-19th century. In the 1970s, their tribe sued to regain 1,800 acres of Charlestown land, and in 1983, the tribe regained federal recognition. In celebrating the court victory, Rhode Island state officials were openly anti-tribal sovereignty. Governor Carceri declared that the ruling clearly implicated that all state laws would apply to tribal members no matter where they were located. Tribal leaders see it as the latest attempt at judicial termination, citing the state's illegal detribalization of the Narragansett in 1880. Chief Sasham Thomas said, "I don't know why Carceri and his gang feel this issue is dead. We intend pursuing justice until we receive it." The Narragansett, however, are not the only ones affected by this ruling. It threatens to remove from tribal rule land all over the nation that has been restored to tribes since the 1934 Act. According to NARF, the Native American Rights Fund, the court's decision is in direct contradiction to over 70 years of Department of Interior practice and interpretation of the law. The Indian Reorganization Act's central purpose was to organize tribal governments and to restore land bases to tribes that had been torn apart by earlier federal policies. The Supreme Court's decision, which is based on a novel new interpretation of a couple sentences in the Reorganization Act, could end up calling into question the validity of tribal business organizations and the contracts and loans they have entered. It could end up affecting public safety and other service provision on tribal lands across the country. So why this ruling now? It may have to do with the current makeup of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has never been more friendly to business than now. Case after case has been brought by the Chamber of Commerce with great success. In fact, under Chief Justice Roberts, a significantly higher percentage of the Chamber's cases have managed to be heard than cases brought by any other organization or entity. And the court has ruled in their favor at a much higher rate. The case in Rhode Island was not brought by the Chamber of Commerce, but it was very much about business. In particular, casinos and other tribal businesses that operate under tribal laws on tribal land, with the proceeds of those businesses controlled by tribal governments outside the reach of state coffers. The repercussions for tribes will certainly be felt for a long time, with lots of litigation in the future. There is also talk among Indian activists of appealing to Congress for new laws and of appealing to the United Nations on the rights of indigenous peoples. This is Linda Olsen-Osterlin for the KABU Evening News.
U.S. products ranging from potatoes to pet food will be subject to Mexican tariffs of 10 to 20% in retaliation for the cancellation of a NAFTA cross-border trucking program. The list published today by the Mexican government comprises 90 U.S. products, also including many fruits and products such as toilet paper and sunglasses. The trucking program is one of the last and largest disputes between the U.S. and Mexico over the 1994 NAFTA Accords. In 2001, Mexico brought the case before the Dispute Resolution Panel, which recommended that the United States comply with the program and allow Mexican trucks within its borders.
The Obama administration today formally endorsed a UN statement calling for the worldwide decriminalization of homosexuality, a measure that former President George W. Bush had refused to sign. The move was the administration's latest in reversing Bush-era decisions that have been heavily criticized by human rights and other groups. the United States was the only Western nation not to sign on to the declaration when it came up at the UN General Assembly in December. Gay rights groups hailed the move. The declaration was opposed by the Vatican.
The World Bank reduced its forecast of China's 2009 growth to 6.5% from 7.5% due to plunging exports, but expressed confidence in Beijing's ability to keep the world's third-largest economy expanding amid global turmoil. The drop in trade will hurt investment and job creation, the bank said in a quarterly report, but it said China still should grow faster than other major countries due to its huge stimulus package and strong banks, which were unhurt by the global crisis.
In one of the world's driest places, some of the world's poorest women have created an organic farming collective. KBOO's Crystal Lady explains.
In Sahirabad, in the arid interior of southern India, a collective of 5,000 women is providing a local response to global warming. The women, members of the lowest rung of India's stratified society, have shown it is possible to adapt to climate change by following a system of interspersing crops that do not need extra water, chemical products, or pesticides. They grow organically, planting as many as 19 indigenous crops on 1 acre of their lands. And they've been aided in this by an organization called the Deccan Development Society. The DDS has been working in India for 25 years and has helped the women acquire land and form local self-help groups. The women now run a uniquely evolved system of crop financing, and they're involved in a monitored system of organic produce that is certified by India's Organic Council. The women are now able to provide for educating their children and for buying land, cattle, and a home for their families. Reporting for KBOO Evening News, this is Crystal Lee.
And now the latest news developments from Israel and the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, March 18, 2009. Israeli troops demolish homes in Jerusalem and kidnap civilians in morning invasions. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. One house, two Bedouin huts and an animal shed owned by Palestinians near Jerusalem City were demolished on Wednesday by the Israeli authorities. All the demolitions took place in El Azariya, a Palestinian town just outside East Jerusalem. The home, owned by Rabia El-Khmari, was demolished on Wednesday midday. Israel says the home is built on an Israeli area without the necessary documents, while the other structures are close to the Israeli wall being built there.
My house is legal. I have all needed documents. Anyway, the house is built in a Palestinian-controlled area, not an Israeli area. When my son asked them for the demolition order, they beat him up.
Palestinian sources in Jerusalem City said on Wednesday that Israel have handed out 80 new demolition orders to homes owned by Palestinians in Jerusalem City. Israel has intensified its campaign of demolishing Palestinian-owned homes in the city since the start of 2009. The Jerusalem municipality handed out demolition orders to 96 Palestinian families in the first week of March, while another 88 such orders in February. Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, the authorities have rarely given Palestinian residents permission to build homes. The Israeli government has continued to build Jewish settlements in and around Jerusalem and throughout the West Bank, an act which violates the international law and all peace agreements signed between Israel and the Palestinians since the 1993 Oslo Accords. In other news, Israeli troops have kidnapped at least 15 Palestinian civilians during morning invasions, targeting a number of West Bank areas on Wednesday. Israeli Army Radio reported that the army took all those kidnapped to detention camps for questioning. The radio added that all are on the army's wanted list. Palestinian sources said that Israeli soldiers kidnapped 7 men from the northern West Bank city of Nablus and nearby refugee camps. Witnesses said that Israeli troops searched and ransacked homes before taking the men away. The other 8 were taken by the Israeli army during a similar attack targeting the village of Al-Shuk near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Mary Arthur and Ghazan Benoura.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we are open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Brendan Grubb. Special thanks to reporters Linda Olsen-Osterlin, Crystal Leedy, Khalib Sepulela. Our engineer is Brendan Grubb. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on the KABU website at kboo.fm. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K26 4AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K22 0HR. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, Joanne Bowman and Dave Mazza check in on the Oregon legislature. What's in store for issues such as closing the budget gap, reviving Oregon's economy, and saving public services? At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, host Per Fagering speaks with Saul Landau, scholar, author, commentator, and filmmaker. They'll discuss 2 recent articles by Mr. Landau called Capitalism Has Failed, Face the Facts, and Israeli Policy Gives Jews a Bad Name. They'll also touch on the recent elections in El Salvador. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, Investigative News Radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, host Marianne Barisonic interviews local producers of Ink-Filled Page, a quarterly journal of fiction, nonfiction, and artwork from Indigo Editing and Publications. And at 11:30, Martha Odom interviews Oregon writer Annette White Parks about her book, Cuttings from the Field as Traveling with My Scots Grannies. White Parks looks at the world and experiences of Scottish women down through the centuries. That's all right here on KBOO. Stay tuned right now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News, and have a great evening.
From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 18, 2009. The Senate moves forward on President Obama's trade agenda. A long string of unsolved murders motivates First Nations women leaders in Canada to call for action. And we'll go to Chile and hear about local communities that are struggling to keep their water. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, embattled insurance giant AIG and the government regulators in charge of overseeing the company received a tongue-lashing from members of Congress. At a hearing on Capitol Hill, AIG Chief Executive Edward Libby defended his actions over the past 6 months when he took over at the company. This despite the public outrage at news that AIG executives received $165 million in bonuses that came from the taxpayer-funded bailout.
I'm trying desperately to prevent an uncontrolled collapse of that business. This is the only way to improve AIG's ability to pay taxpayers back quickly and completely, and the only way to avoid a systemic shock to the economy that the U.S. government helped was meant to relieve. Make no mistake, had I been CEO at the time, I would never have approved the retention contracts that were put in place over a year ago.
Liddy says he has asked executives who received bonuses to return at least half, but the relatively small size of this concession did not sit well with many in Congress, including Michigan Democrat Gary Peters.
There are thousands of UAW employees who have employment contracts, and they've been told that they need to renegotiate those contracts and make concessions to justify taxpayer investments. There are thousands of white-collar employees with employment contracts who have foregone promised bonuses and benefits and have taken pay cuts in order to save the companies that they work for. People are sick of this double standard where working class and middle-class workers are treated differently than the financial industry executives. What people are looking for is a sense of shared sacrifice.
Lawmakers are trying to devise a plan to recoup the bonus money and have suggested several measures, from a targeted tax to lawsuits. The U.S. State Department has given security contracts to Blackwater just days after it said it would not renew ties with the controversial company, Africa Jones reports.
The State Department said in January that it would not renew security contracts with the private security firm Blackwater, but soon after, the department approved a $22 million contract for security personnel. According to the Washington Times, the new contracts extend the stay of the company, now known as Z, in Iraq by several months. Iraqi officials said in January they would no longer license Blackwater in the country. Scott Amy, general counsel for the Project on Government Oversight, said that the contract is clearly labeled for security guards and patrol services.
It raises questions about the pressure the United States may be putting on the Iraqi government and when this change went into effect. Why is the government continuing to enter contracts with a contractor that is being barred from working in that country?
Blackwater has been criticized for operating with legal impunity and using excessive force. Six Blackwater contractors have been charged for the shooting death of 17 Iraqis in 2007. Africa Jones, FSRN.
Supporters of an Oakland, California-based activist critically injured in the West Bank while protesting the Israeli border fence are organizing a vigilant protest Friday afternoon at the Israeli consulate in New York City. 38-year-old Tristan Anderson suffered a severe head injury after being hit with a tear gas canister fired by Israeli troops. He was marching with West Bank residents in protest of the security barrier. In a Tel Aviv hospital earlier this week, Anderson was semi-responsive, but any long-term effects of the injury are still unknown. Israel gave Palestinians in Jerusalem demolition orders today as bulldozers began to take down homes. Ghassan Benora of IMEMC.org reports from Israel.
One house and three other structures owned by Palestinians near Jerusalem were demolished by Israeli authorities today. The demolitions took place in Al-Azariya, a Palestinian town outside East Jerusalem. Israel says the home was demolished because it was built in an Israeli area without the needed documentation. However, Rabi Al-Kumari disagrees.
My house is legal. I have all needed documents. The house is built in a Palestinian-controlled area, not an Israeli area. But when my son asked them for the demolition order, they beat him up.
Since February, Israel has issued demolition orders for more than 150 Palestinian homes near Jerusalem. For FSRN, this is Ghassan Barnoura.
In another story about opposition to forced demolition, a massive construction project to widen a national highway in India has sparked violent protests in the northern Indian state of Haryana. Bismila Gilani has more.
Hundreds of residents in the Kalka town of Haryana clashed with the police for the second day today in an attempt to save their shops and homes from the wrecking ball. Dozens of residents were injured as the police charged with batons. The state authorities have deployed thousands of police to quell the resistance. The National Highways Authority of India says the buildings scheduled for demolition are illegal encroachments, which are being removed under court orders. But the residents say they are legal owners of the land. The angry protesters shouted slogans against political parties for not coming to their rescue. They say the parties will now pay for their lack of support in the coming general elections. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The Senate put a face to President Obama's trade agenda. It's confirmed Ron Kirk to be U.S. Trade Representative, and the Senate panel held a confirmation hearing for Gary Locke to be Commerce Secretary. This as Obama's administration enters its first trade dispute with Mexico over Mexican trucks on U.S. highways. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
By a vote of 92-5, the Senate overwhelmingly supported Ron Kirk, the former mayor of Dallas, to be U.S. Trade Representative. Kirk will be the first African-American to hold the cabinet-level position. He supports free trade and has been a proponent of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. Meanwhile, in the Senate Commerce Committee was a confirmation hearing for Obama's third nominee to be Commerce Secretary. Gary Locke, as former governor of Washington State, implemented trade deals with Asia, making Washington the third largest exporting state in the U.S. He received high praise from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. But as Locke is known to be a trade governor, lawmakers questioned Locke on just that. Freshman Senator Mike Johanns, Republican of Nebraska.
There is the official job description for what you do, and then there's kind of the unofficial job description. Now, of course, you have a USTR. You had the rest of us that were working trade issues. But it oftentimes was the Commerce Secretary that in kind of an informal way became the face of trade.
Trade has not been a front burner topic of discussion this political season, with the domestic economy and behavior of Wall Street dominating. But trade has been in the background of nearly every major debate. There was the Buy American provision in the stimulus, a ban on imports of toys with lead paint, and most recently, in the massive omnibus spending bill, Congress canceled a pilot program that would implement a NAFTA provision to allow Mexican trucks on U.S. highways. Mexico responded by announcing it was raising their tariffs on U.S. goods. Republican Senator Mel Martinez, Republican of Florida.
I am concerned about the protectionist attitudes that seem to pervade at this moment in history.
Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, brought up another trade issue.
Warren Buffett himself has indicated you can't consume 3% more than you produce and run trade deficits in the $800 billion range and believe that can be sustainable for your economy. No one is describing these trade deficits as helping undermine this economy and help cause this crisis. It has, but no one wants to talk about it because the minute you talk about it, they suggest somehow you're anti-trade.
Locke responds to the senator's differing views on trade.
Whatever agreements we have, we need to enforce them. If some of the elements of those other of the trade agreements are not enforced, then we have basically given away more than we've gotten back. And as a former prosecutor, I believe in vigorous enforcement of the law, and I will do everything within my power within the Department of Commerce, if confirmed, to enforce those agreements.
During the campaign, then-candidate Obama said NAFTA needs to be renegotiated, and trade deals must include strict labor and environmental protections. Lori Wallach is the director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. She says she will be watching Kirk and Locke because she sees them as free trade advocates.
The appointments he's made since in Commerce and the Trade Representative's office are people who in their past supported the old model. So they will have to take up their job of implementing their boss, the president's plan, and as activists across the country, we'll need to keep an eye on that.
Despite easy confirmation of Kirk and an expected easy confirmation for Locke, President Obama is receiving pressure from Congress to dramatically alter U.S. trade policy to include protections for U.S. workers and the U.S. economy. For FSRN, I'm Leanne Caldwell in Washington, D.C.
Indigenous women leaders in Canada are calling for an emergency strategy in light of hundreds of missing and murdered Indigenous women whose cases remain unsolved. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more from Montreal.
A recent study by the Native Women's Association of Canada has concluded that no less than 510 Indigenous women have gone missing or have been killed across the country since 1980. Since September 2008, five more Native women have gone missing and have been killed in the province of Quebec alone. Maya Robengani is a Native solidarity activist in Montreal who has helped to organize support around some of these cases.
They're demanding, first of all, a basic acknowledgement that there's an issue in Canada. Basically, they feel as though all Native women are not part of public safety at this point. They're asking for a public inquiry into these deaths because there's still 300 unsolved cases. out of the 510, and that means to them that there's 300 people walking around that have killed people, killed these women.
The fact that many of these cases remain unsolved to this day has made this a major issue of concern for Native communities from coast to coast and has launched many into political action. Last summer, hundreds of Native women participated in the Walk for Justice, a protest march from Vancouver to Ottawa to demand action on the part of the Canadian government on this issue. But their protest registered little concern. Beverly Jacobs is a Mohawk lawyer and the president of the Native Women's Association of Canada. She says the Canadian government's inaction on this issue demonstrates wider patterns of colonization and institutional violence against Native communities.
On the bigger picture of violent relationships, Canada is an abuser, and they've used their laws and their processes of institutions to create that and to continue it. The Indian Act still exists. And so that's part of, you know, this relationship that I'm talking about and how it has affected women specifically and the role of women.
In a press conference on Tuesday, Jacobs also pointed out that the number of missing Indigenous women in Canada would be proportional to 18,000 missing women amongst the country's white population. And if that were the case, she says, there would be immediate action taken by the government. The UN recently called on the Canadian government to investigate why hundreds of deaths and disappearances of Indigenous women remain unsolved. An Amnesty International report on this issue from 2004 has asked Ottawa to report back by 2010 in the status of more than 500 cases that have neither been fully investigated nor attracted priority attention, with the perpetrators remaining unpunished. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
Water rights in Chile have been wholly privatized, meaning not just water treatment or distribution, but the rights of waters in rivers, canals, and even snow mountains. This water has been given away to big corporations. Communities in many parts of Chile sometimes take on large business interests who deny farmers access to water sources, and a new movement is building in response to corporate-built dams that will generate hydropower at the expense of community needs and the environment. FSRN's Jorge Garletón reports from Santiago.
The south of Chile holds the second largest freshwater reserve in the world. And in this region, freshwater use and rights are a major source of conflict. One example is a project by two electrical utilities, the Chilean-based Colbún and Italian-owned Endesa. The utilities control Chile's water resources. And these days, Colbún and Endesa are busy. The companies are planning to build 7 hydroelectric dams by stopping flow of 5 rivers in the Panguipulli region south of the country. These companies plan to use water rights before they expire. Building the dams first, the companies plan to generate electricity to the national market and sell surplus to Argentina. But the news spurred the local community to organize a citizen group against the project. They say the plan will ruin their communities. Groups say the dams will damage rural areas which survive on agriculture and green tourism, the wild rivers, lush forests, thermal waters, and rich heritage of Mapuche people's indigenous life would change for the worse. Pedro Carran is a medical doctor with Panguipulli Residents Against the Dams.
The voracity to build 7 mega hydro projects in a water reserve in the south of the world, to us it was something unthinkable. It's crazy. All of us agreed that we will not negotiate nor seek financial compensation from the hydro companies. What we want is very clear. We want this part of the globe, and hopefully the rest of the world, to become a world life reserve where we respect cultural diversity, biological and water diversity.
But this is not the only water conflict in Chile. There are dozens of small to large conflicts since the power utility companies began extracting water resources indiscriminately. Lucio Cuenca is with the environmental NGO Latin American Environmental Conflict Observatory, OLCA.
Throughout Chile, we are seeing a series of conflicts caused by water scarcity. Water sources are drying up, and the mining industry needs plenty of water. It takes the water and contaminates it, which means it cannot be reused. They leave behind many farming and indigenous communities without water. People have been forced to leave their communities in mountain regions, agricultural valley in Chile's north and Andean region, because they have been left without water.
Cuencas says the Copepo Valley at the edge of the Atacama Desert, which produces table grapes for the U.S. market, has enough water to last only for the next 4 years. If water runs out, agriculture could say its days numbered. That could have a big impact on the economy, as agriculture is a major source of local employment. Groups blame the mining operations that have run the water dry. Meanwhile, the water sources are drying up in the desert north. Australia's BHP Billiton plans to build a $3.5 billion seawater desalination plant to feed its mine. The company owns Escondida, the largest copper mine in the world. And another mining company, Antofagasta Minerals, has already invested $200 million in seawater pumping. The ownership of water rights is a growing political issue, especially because the electrical and mining companies are trading their rights like any other commodity. Senator Guido Girardi is working to build a diverse coalition aimed at nationalizing water rights. Girardi explains why.
The reality is that Chile is the only country in the world that, as a result of a completely illegitimate action during the Pinochet dictatorship, changed water rights that historically belonged to the nation as a public resource, like in Europe and the rest of Latin America, into private property. Because of private ownership, water rights are outside the control and regulation from the state. All other countries in the world, water rights are publicly owned, and the state leases those rights but reserves the right to regulate its use.
This is not the case in Chile. Water rights are in the hands of five conglomerates led by Endesa, the Italian-owned multinational electrical utility. Endesa owns 55% of all water rights in the country. So far, Girardi is one of the few politicians campaigning for legislative changes to return water rights to Chileans. And this initiative has the support of many activists and local communities. And while southern Chile is the world's second largest freshwater reserve in the world, Quillangua in northern Chile has a new record too, as the driest place in the last 37 years. That fact is a wake-up call for Chile. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Hopes for a power-sharing government between political rivals in Zimbabwe are diminishing. The invasions of white-owned commercial farms, the detention of opposition activists, and anti-Western taunts by President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF party continue. As Davidson Makanga reports from neighboring South Africa, analysts are skeptical of the new government's ability to move forward.
The power-sharing government formed by political rivals Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front and the two formations of the Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, is showing little signs of taking off. Continuing invasions of white-owned commercial farms, detention of MDC activists, and unrest tones by President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF leave some analysts skeptical of the new government's ability to tackle the enormous challenges. Political commentator Farai Maguru says there is a clear divide in Zimbabwe's huge inclusive government. He says if any signs of antagonism are anything to go by, the structure is set for failure.
One side of the government is trying to do their best, but they've got the other side of government, which is mainly ZANU-PF, which is trying to preserve the status quo and continue with business as usual.
The controversy surrounding the new government runs deeper. Women's rights activists are outraged by the low representation of female politicians in the new unity government. There are only four women in the 35-member cabinet, far short of the equal representation of women in decision-making that Zimbabwe signed onto together with other Southern African countries last year. Zimbabwe is a signatory to the Southern African Development Community Protocol on Gender and Development, which stipulates that women be equally represented in decision-making posts in both public and private sectors by 2015. Cleopatra Njove, director of the non-governmental organization Women in Politics Support Unit, described the gender bias selection of cabinet ministers as shocking and said, she challenged the political parties to implement their quota systems by granting women opportunities to exercise real power.
The global political agreement, for example, and several other regional and international instruments that Zimbabwe is a signatory to, have spoken to the need to ensure that we have better representation of women in decision-making positions. But again, at such an early stage as this, the three political parties have not committed to what it is that they actually promised was going to happen.
The two formations of the Movement for Democratic Change, one led by Morgan Tsvangirai and the other by Arthur Mutambara, appointed 16 ministers but chose only three women. President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF only contributed one woman to his cabinet complement of 15. Olivia Mchena was allocated the Women's Affairs Department. Vice President and ZANU-PF member Joyce Mujiru believes women should fend for themselves instead of relying on quotas to get into power. She told the state-run Herald newspaper the low representation of women in high positions was unfortunate, but blamed women for not fighting hard enough for decision-making positions. Priscilla Msiairambwe Mishonga, the MDC's new Minister of Regional Integration and International Trade, said she was disappointed by the low numbers of women in cabinet, but confident that she and her colleagues would make their marks by championing women's issues during their tenure.
And as a feminist, I'm very disappointed in terms of the numbers that made it to cabinet. But I think what we did as negotiators, what is in the global political agreement, is that we did set a foundation in terms of how we are going to be operating, making sure that as we begin to address of these great issues, there is the feminization of all those issues, whether it's health, whether it's HIV/AIDS, whether it's food security. So that discussion will certainly be taking place. Unfortunately, whilst you've got a few women on that cabinet, most of those women are women's activists, and I'm sure we'll be able to speak out.
Speaking during the height of political violence last year at the release of a report on trauma women in Zimbabwe have experienced, activist Jane Williams called for a genuinely different government.
We believe that the most appropriate government to replace the current illegitimate incumbent would be a non-political transition authority whose members have as a priority transitional process of healing, transforming and rebuilding. Such an authority will have the capacity and neutrality necessary to dismantle the structures of violence and oppression.
And even the continuing arrest and harassment of activists, including members of the MDC and Williams organization, Women of Zimbabwe Arise, is an indication. The power-sharing government has not yet taken up the task of healing a battered nation. For Interpress Service and FSRIN, this is Debson Makanga in Cape Town, South Africa.
A string of violent attacks by Republican Army dissidents against British Army personnel and policemen in Northern Ireland in the past 2 weeks has proven to be the biggest test of the decade-long peace that has held in the province. Yesterday was St. Patrick's Day, an inherently political affair in Northern Ireland. FSRN's Don Duncan was there and files this reporter's notebook.
This year's St. Patrick's Day parade in Belfast looked like any other. As always, there are the hundreds of children skipping around with green ribbons in their hair, the adults with generous sprays of shamrock pinned to their chests or small Irish flags clasped in their hands, and the massive floats that carry towering papier-mâché figures from Celtic mythology. But this year's parade was different in that it weaved its way through a Belfast wrestling once again with its old sectarian demons. David Power, a young Catholic marching in the parade, said the violence brought him back to the dark days when people were scared to leave their houses. He said it all served to remind people how fragile peace really is for them and how easily it can disappear. A man stood facing the crowd, shouting out religious verses and calling people to think of the true origins of St. Patrick. Nearby, young schoolgirls bopped to the beats of Rihanna. The mood was upbeat, festive, and thousands of people lined the streets to watch the colourful parade pass in all its shades of green. And there is much to celebrate. Northern Ireland has enjoyed 10 years of unbroken peace, but the deep sectarian fault lines that once fractured this society still remain underneath the surface. And now there are people, thought not to number more than 300, who are willing to exploit these dormant tensions and bring violence back onto the streets here. So far, all the attacks have been one-sided, from marginal radical Republican groups targeting army and police personnel. But the big worry here now is that loyalist dissident groups will launch reprisal attacks on the Republican community, and that the violence will escalate into the kind of tit-for-tat sectarian conflict that had Northern Ireland in a chokehold for 30 years. The people here know how quickly the pendulum can swing. "There was a time I couldn't imagine peace coming to Northern Ireland," said James Steadman, a 75-year-old Protestant who found himself in the thick of the parade by accident. He had come into town to buy religious books and had taken a wrong turn to find himself surrounded by pipe bands, enormous floats, and children running around in Guinness hats. "Peace here is a miracle," he said heavily, "but it also shows that anything can happen, even if we don't want it." Don Duncan, FSRN, Belfast.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN. We're supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by dropping us an email at comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
On Friday, March 20th, 6 to 7 p.m., Bread and Roses reflects on an incredible but true story of rebellion. Tired of government propaganda, thousands of women occupied a major TV station and began broadcasting their own programs. Angered by cuts to education, tens of thousands took to the streets to protect and support striking teachers. On Friday, March 20th, Bread and Roses reflects on this true story of a teacher's rebellion in Mexico. We'll hear from the women who took over the TV station and perspectives from a renowned filmmaker who has documented people's protests around the world, featuring music by Oaxaca native Lila Downs. That's Teacher's Rebellion, Friday, March 20th, 6 to 7 p.m.
On February 4th, Sheriff Joe Arpaio paraded more than 200 immigrants in shackles through the streets of Phoenix, Arizona. Their destination? A tent city, surrounded by an electric shock fence. The incident, characterized by public humiliation and segregation of unsentenced inmates based on race and national origin, brought national attention to the ongoing civil and human rights abuses in Maricopa County, Arizona. The National Day Labor Organizing Network, ENDLON, called for members and allies to conduct teach-ins in their own communities nationwide and requested representatives from across the country convene in Phoenix on February 27th and 28th. Portland held its first teach-in on Monday, February 23rd at Jobs with Justice. Later that week, delegates from Portland organizations, both Workers' Education Project, the Center for Intercultural Organizing, and the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee joined representatives from 12 states in Arizona to strategize and demand an end to 287G agreements nationally, to stop the ICE raids, and demand just and comprehensive immigration reform. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll bring you interviews from some of the organizers and concerned individuals among the thousands who took to the streets in support of human rights on February 28th. Our feature interviews are with three Phoenix-based immigrant rights activists: Sylvia Herrera of the Puente Movement, Antonio Bustamante
and Jason Odner. We'll also have updates and resources for you to get involved. Stay tuned for Circle A Radio.
My name is Jason Odner, and I am an immigrants' rights organizer in Phoenix, Arizona. Here in Maricopa County, we're dealing with a lot of issues, including a legislature that's very anti-immigrants, a governor that's hyper-conservative, but also the biggest concern is the behavior of county government, and specifically the behavior of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. Joe Arpaio has been engaging in a lot of racial profiling, and his department has a lot of very, very concerning behaviors. So what we've been doing is we've been doing major petition drives through several different organizations, including ACORN, the Maricopa Citizens for Safety and Accountability. We've also been sending delegations to D.C., trying to talk to legislators. And most importantly, we've been doing a lot of radio response. When he moves into a Hispanic neighborhood, he'll bring in hundreds of vehicles, hundreds of deputies into predominantly Hispanic neighborhoods without regard to crime rates or any actual legitimate law enforcement reason. Just start pulling over random cars with Hispanic drivers for cracked windshields, broken taillights, silly reasons, just as a pretense to check the documentation. So what we start doing is going in there with many, many organized, sometimes hundreds of activists, cameras, video cameras, audio recording devices, and just doing extensive documentation of almost every stop that we can to try to get solid evidence of the racial profiling, which it's not hard to get documentation of that since it was so rampant and so flagrant in many instances. And this evidence has now been brought to the Judicial Committee in D.C. and to other legislators. We're trying to use that to force an investigation. There are several House committees that have promised to investigate this. The one that's gone public with it so far is the Judicial Committee, which is very important. The Judicial Committee has oversight over the Justice Department and also over the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security is relevant because Arpaio is using the authority and resources from the Department of Homeland Security through what's called a 287G agreement. 287G agreements give resources and some training and federal authority to local law enforcement to enforce federal immigration law. Now, what we're seeing is not just in Maricopa County, but across the nation, wherever these 287Gs are implemented, they're resulting fairly consistently in some really egregious human rights abuses, racial profiling, and other problems. But Maricopa County has the largest 287G agreement in the nation, and it's seen as a testing ground for this program. So if these types of abuses are allowed to continue here, and if we allow this program to be perceived as a success here, if we fail to make these abuses visible, then we expect these 287Gs to spread and be used more and more extensively throughout the country. So it's important that we put a stop to it as quickly as we can.
Can you talk about some of the consequences of living in a county that has a sheriff like Arpaio?
First of all, Arpaio's human rights abuses aren't just limited to immigrants. A lot of people are being beat up in the jails. He brags with glee about how punitive he makes his jail system. For example, he has a tent city with no air conditioning, 115 degrees. People are denied medical care. People are denied access to adequate food and water, and the vast majority of these people are unsentenced. They're awaiting trial. And of course, if you're awaiting trial and you have money, you're out on bail, so there's a class issue as well. But even if we do limit it to just talking about his immigration enforcement policies, what he refers to as immigration enforcement policies, it's not even meaningful immigration enforcement. So even if we were in support of tougher immigration enforcement, which I'm not, even then it's not really meaningful. But it puts whole communities at risk because it's very important that local law enforcement be able to have a trusting and positive, productive relationship with communities. So, for example, let's say an immigrant is raped or assaulted. They need to feel safe going to the police as a victim. Or if you or I were assaulted and an immigrant were to witness it, then they would have to feel safe going to the police as a witness and say, I know who the bad guy is. So when you draw this line down the community and you create a situation where a significant percentage of the population of a city is afraid to interact with the law enforcement, the police cannot do their job. And Phoenix Police Chief Jack Harris has said just this. Any police department has some history of abuses. But overall, the Phoenix Police have worked very hard to create a culture of community policing and trusting relationships. And they've worked for decades to try to get trust in the communities. And Arpaio's people will then come into a community and they'll destroy all of that work because these inner communities often don't differentiate between police and sheriff's department.
My name is Sylvia Herrera,
and I'm part of a movement called Puente, which means bridge. We've been bridging different communities to dialogue and to interact and to participate in a movement to unite different communities to address issues that we're having to confront as migratory families, like the raids of Sheriff Joe Arpaio here in Maricopa County and the 287G agreement, which is an agreement between local enforcement like Arpaio and ICE. So there's been a lot of new faces coming on board that we've been able to inform. And once people are informed, there's more participation.
Have you seen that both locally and nationally?
Yes, definitely, definitely. February 28th, we had an incredible showing of support here in Phoenix. We had a march protest that 4 miles to the federal courthouse. We went by the Wells Fargo, where Arpaio has 2 floors of luxury offices in the Wells Fargo tower. And we also passed by the offices of ICE. But we were well over 5,000 people and probably closer to 8,000 people that participated in that protest.
And how was that compared to other protest marches that have happened in Phoenix against Sheriff Arpaio and his policies?
Well, this was the most showing specifically that we have seen of people that are being directly affected. We have had other types of protests, specifically at the downtown in Wells Fargo, but people were there that to say, we are not afraid of Joe Arpaio. He has the whole community, and I'm talking about business people that are afraid to confront him publicly. We're talking about elected officials that are afraid, and just in general, there's been a fear. But that day, you could see and hear people saying, we will no longer be in the shadows of fear. There was this public outcry that was amazing and incredible. And I think, well, I know that other cities are supporting our efforts here, because they know that whatever is happening here is happening in their community, maybe not to the extent or the level that's happening here in Maricopa County, but certainly there's always that possibility that their local enforcement will sign on to the 287G agreement, like Arpaio.
And really, it's a... Once that happens, it leaves people very vulnerable. It seems to be a reign of terror in your community.
Yes, it is. Certainly, there's that evidence that is constantly coming forth where people are being racially profiled. And when I witnessed 2 small children, 4 and 6 year old, crying for their mom that was detained and then deported, when you see the children crying for their mom and then being told by masked deputies to get out of the car and kiss their mommy goodbye before they take her away, you can imagine the trauma and terror that these children and families are, you know, is being felt in our community. It's just a terrible situation that a lot of people can't even imagine that this would be happening in the year 2009. For the mere fact of, in this particular instance, the woman had not paid a traffic ticket and being handled as a criminal. Anybody else would have been cited and told she needed to go take care of that traffic ticket. But it's story after story that we hear from families or individuals that is really a heartbreak. And at the same time, when we took the video of these children crying earlier, when we first got on the scene of this, the deputy or posse told us that we could not film. Later on, the sheriff's department admitted that it's unconstitutional for them to tell us that we could not film. So there's a lot of people's civil rights and human rights violations that are occurring here.
I think it's new to a lot of people, actually, that there's these posses, the masked men that you referred to. Could you explain a little bit to our listeners here in Oregon who these people are?
These posses, they're volunteers that are deputized to assist in these supposedly crime suppression sweeps. A lot of them are retired individuals that, frankly, you know, we have evidence where Arpaio is actually linked to some of the hate group members. And so it's very likely that these posse or volunteer deputies are part of those groups as well. So that's the type of law enforcement that is being conducted here in Maricopa County.
You are listening to Circle A Radio. We're talking with immigrant rights advocates in Maricopa County.
Well, my name is Antonio Bustamante. I'm an attorney. I do criminal defense for a living. However, in my spare time, I work with other immigrant rights activists, in particular in the area of articulating the human rights abuses, the constitutional and civil rights abuses that are being perpetrated against them here in Maricopa County, principally by the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office.
Could you give us some historical background of the immigrant rights struggle and how it is a continuation of the civil rights movement?
It's a continuation of the civil rights movement in that we are seeing the repeat of civil rights deprivations against a class of people because they are members of a class. In the 50s and 60s, the struggle against Jim Crow and segregation and all the horrors those brought, including lynchings and so on, had to do with a class of people, and the class was identified by race. And here in Maricopa County, throughout Arizona, but particularly in the fourth largest county of the nation, Maricopa County, the urban heart of Arizona, there has been a concerted attack sanctioned by law, or the misuse of law, against people of color, brown people who are undocumented. And that's all it has taken to cause a groundswell of resentment and expression of hatred against anybody who is Latino-looking. Whether they be citizens or not, there is the expression of hatred for people who are undocumented. It has been allowed to run rampant, and anyone who's brown is suspected of being undocumented and has become the object of hatred, not by everybody in the county or in this society, but by far, far too many. And it is very sad. It is horrifying. It is a sad commentary on the state of human rights in a country that, up to this point, has always tried to give the impression that the civil rights struggle was successful, and get over it now, move on. Well, it's still ongoing. There's still horrible racism here. And it is now a situation where laws have been enacted in Arizona that are specifically designed to be used against the undocumented, much as, in my opinion, laws were created in the Third Reich to be used solely against Jews. What I'm referring to is laws that make it impossible for an undocumented person to have a driver's license, whereas up until 10, 12 years ago, the undocumented could have driver's licenses. It is a group of people that are required to work, lured into this country to work, and make all of our lives nice and sweet as we've had them. But by the same token, and at the same time, it is a group of people for whom laws have been enacted to make their ability to serve the unquenchable needs of the majority in terms of labor, their efforts have been made more and more difficult to carry out. And the irony is, using undocumented labor has become the de facto immigration system of the nation. The country has refused for decades to enact a sensible, rational immigration policy through its myriad of immigration laws, complicated laws, made more complicated than they need to be made. And so what we have is a continuing need for labor from abroad, a continuing refusal to have a rational immigration system, the continuation of people thereby being driven into an underclass, into the shadows, and laws perpetrated against them to make them suffer more and more. They cannot have IDs, they cannot have driver's licenses, they cannot have social security numbers, and now the fabricated use of those kinds of documentation or invented social security numbers results in felony convictions and justification to be arrested and taken into custody by law enforcement, whereas those kinds of laws did not exist before, or if they existed, were not enforced. But new laws have been enacted to make it easier to arrest people for false identification.
And there was another law that you mentioned that would strike most people as pretty absurd, and that was something about smuggling oneself across the border. Can you talk about that?
3 years ago, the state legislature enacted a law designed to go after the coyotes, the human smugglers, okay? And there are federal laws against it, but the state wanted to stop it also through its prosecutions. And the legislators who passed that, it's understandable that they would pass that kind of law. Okay, the coyotes can be brutal, horrible human beings that prey upon the undocumented. And I can understand, all society, I think, can understand why we have laws against human smugglers. But that's not how the law is used very often. Every now and then it is when they catch people in a drop house who are considered to be the human smugglers, or who are driving a van with a driver, is prosecuted for smuggling people into the county, into the state. However, the majority of the prosecutions have been used under a conspiracy theory of the law to prosecute the very victims of smugglers, the boyos or the undocumented. They are prosecuted and persecuted for conspiring to smuggle themselves into the nation. And it's being used like a hammer, and very proudly by the prosecutors, as if that's somehow going to stop undocumented immigration, which will not stop until the country's insatiable and the state's insatiable need for foreign labor is met through a proper immigration regulatory authority.
So that law is still in the books then?
Yeah, that statute, in fact, its use of the conspiracy statute to be applied against the undocumented in human smuggling, under the new human smuggling statute, has been upheld recently by the Arizona Court of Appeals. So it's just a lovely state of affairs here. Anything goes in apartheid Arizona.
That was Antonio Bustamante, attorney and immigrant rights advocate in Phoenix, Arizona. This is Circle A Radio. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 in Portland, Oregon. Next up, Sylvia Herrera of the Puente Movement.
I think there was the national outcry when Arpaio paraded the inmates that are being detained and will be deported, where he separated them from the rest of the inmates and took them to a special section, put them in a tent city, and he put an electric fence around it because supposedly these type of people are real good about escaping. And so there was national outcry when people saw that. And within 2 weeks, we were able to have national participation. There were over 500 people that showed up in Phoenix for that march. But we were able to mobilize thousands of people within a very short period of time.
Mi nombre es Eleazar Francisco Vázquez Cáceres. Soy salvadoreño y vivo en Los Ángeles, California, y represento a las Labor Exchange de Malibu, California.
¿Y por qué veniste a Phoenix, Arizona hoy?
Porque necesitamos dar apoyo a los compañeros que están sufriendo sobre la represión del sheriff Arpaio. Tenemos el deseo de que nuestra raza sea respetada y que todos los seres humanos tenemos los mismos derechos porque Dios nos creó iguales.
¿Y cómo es la situación actual allá en California?
Desesperante porque no hay trabajo, pero estamos unidos luchando para lograr una reforma migratoria.
Entonces, ¿tu esperanza es que finalmente vamos a lograr una reforma?
Sí, esa es mi esperanza y tengo seguridad en el presidente actual.
Muy bien. ¿Y qué más quieres compartir con la gente allá en Portland y los demás escuchando?
A toda la familia hispanoparlante, que no tengan miedo, que luchen, porque todos los hispanos estamos unidos. Y vivimos en esta gran nación de los Estados Unidos, la queremos, la respetamos, la cuidamos y son la base de la economía y nuestros hijos la base del futuro.
No more Joe! No more Joe! No more Joe! No more Joe!
What's your name?
Erica.
And why are you out here today?
I'm out here because Arpaio is taking moms away from kids.
What does your sign say?
Stop hurting the children.
And is this your brother?
Yes, I'm his brother. My name is Julio. I'm 10, and I'm here to help kids who don't have homes. They should just leave them with their moms and take them back, because when they grow up, they're just going to be over there.
You're out here with your whole family?
Not my whole family, part of it.
So what would you like to see happen? Do you think it's time for Sheriff Joe to go?
Of course. My sign says, do you really want to leave me without a mommy?
Hi, what's your name?
Marco.
Hi, Marco. And what are you doing out here today? Are you marching?
Yes.
And what does your sign say?
This is our country.
Moms, what does your sign say?
Our sign says, Arpaio equals hate, racism, and injustice. He is doing an injustice with us. This is not fair for all of us. We need to do something about it, and together we could do it.
You guys know that you're a symbol for the entire country?
Oh, yes. We hope we make a difference, and we're out here for all the people that couldn't make it, and we're showing our proudness for this country.
Can I tell you that in Columbia County, Oregon, there was a group of people who are marching against an anti-immigrant ordinance about a week and a half ago, and they were scared to come out because they were being threatened by community members, and they said, if they can do it in Arizona, we can do it here.
Yes, that's great, and I think that's very good for all of us. And we are also out here for the people that could not make it for special reasons or for the people who are scared, but I just want to say something very important, that together we could make it. We could make a difference in this world.
My name is Elisa Ringholm, and I am development staff for the Latino Union of Chicago. And we came to Phoenix primarily because we are a member organization of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, NDLON, who organized this whole march. That's sort of like the front reason, but I mean, the real reason we came was to be in solidarity with those who are affected by the raids and by the institutionalized racism that's perpetuated by 287G here in Arizona, in Maricopa County.
And what's going on in Chicago? Can you give us an idea of what the organizing is like there?
Yeah. In Chicago, we have had both successes and challenges. I'll start with the good and then go to the bad. So we recently passed the Cicero Sanctuary Ordinance, which makes the suburb of Chicago, Cicero, that has 85,000 Latino citizens, a safe space for immigrants. It prohibits police and federal immigration collaboration, as well as documentation-based discrimination. So no immigrants there have to live in fear of calling the police if they've been a victim of a crime or going to the hospital if they need some kind of medical attention like it was previously. So that's a success we had after a long two-year campaign. Challenges are street corner day laborers experience some of the highest rates of abuse in any labor sector because they are inherently in the shadows. And they go to street corners every day to wait for work. In Chicago, we got down to negative 30 with wind chill this winter, and they're out there at the street corner. Everybody knows about the winters. Police harassment is very much a reality. Police will drive their cars onto the sidewalks where the workers are waiting for work, where they have been waiting for work for 30 years, and push them physically off of the sidewalk with their police car. There's a park where day laborers are waiting every day in Albany Park. It's a neighborhood. It's the most diverse neighborhood in Chicago. And police come every day at 10 a.m. and kick the day laborers out, which is completely illegal. It's a public space. So that's a problem. Also, Chicago's rapidly gentrifying with increased development in most neighborhoods on the north side. And so many corners, there's one in a city, in a neighborhood called Avondale, where day laborers are experiencing harassment from business owners and high-income neighbors. And so some of the work that we do is sort of work as a mediator and an advocate for the day laborers. We do a lot of dialogues, we do a lot of policy work, and we work on the ground with the day laborers to improve social and economic conditions. We also have a worker center to provide an alternative hiring space from the street corner, where we do workplace skills training, ESOL classes, and it's a community space for neighborhood events and dialogues and stuff like that.
Great. So what would you like to see happen on a national level?
Well, I think a start would be to admit that our immigration system is broken and that our current policies are contributing to extreme suffering in communities of color throughout the whole nation and the most marginalized communities, and furthering the marginalization of communities and the poor. I think the first step is admitting that and recognizing that. I think secondly, we need to engage in a long-term process of reforming our immigration system, one that's realistic, inclusive, and just. And I've spoken with lawyers who work for immigrant rights on the national level, and I said, well, what would that look like? What would immigration actually look like? And they say, well, dealing with 12 million people, processing 12 million people is a huge task, and we don't know what that looks like. However, I don't think it's going to come tomorrow or after the next march, but I think we have to continue with our efforts to organize, to raise awareness about what's happening, and to give voice to those who can not speak most of the time for themselves. But I definitely think a long-term process of reform needs to be engaged by the new administration.
So, just to start, what's your name?
Deborah O'Dowd.
And why are you out here today?
Oh, to stand up for my students, but also to get rid of Joe Arpaio.
Yeah. What's it like at your school? Who are your students?
Most of my students speak Spanish. Many of the families, somebody in the family may or may not be documented. They're hardworking people. They're really smart.
So you want to see Joe Arpaio stop?
Yes, I do, because I'm a teacher, and this is our community. So these are our families. We are intermarried. We have given them our love, our educational resources, and a lot of our time. They're growing up, and they're going to be voters, and we don't want them to leave the state of Arizona and leave us all alone with Joe Arpaio and all those people like Russell Pierce who love to hate.
You just heard some brief interviews from the National Gathering in March Against Joe Arpaio and the federal program he currently uses to racially profile residents of Maricopa County, separate families, and spread fear through the community, the 287G program. This is Circle A Radio, broadcasting from KBOO in Portland, Oregon. The Southern Poverty Law Center extensively documents hate groups around the country. In particular, you can find information on Arizona State Representative Russell Pierce, just another example of how white supremacists and so-called nativists have infiltrated the mainstream in the U.S. I asked Phoenix activist Jason Odner to comment on hate groups in Arizona and their ties with Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
There is a group called United for a Sovereign America, and it started with Minutemen, but this was a group that broke away from the Minutemen because they felt the Minutemen weren't radical and assertive enough, which those who have had significant interaction with Minutemen realize that that's a rather scary premise. So United for a Sovereign America was started by, I believe, Rusty Childress, a Kia dealer who is extremely anti-immigrant and anti-Hispanic. United for Sovereign America has been a big supporter of Joe Arpaio, and there's significant cross-membership between them and other white supremacist groups, the American Nazi Party. There have been meetings that we have audio footage of where people are bragging about having attended Klan meetings in the past. And on several of their meetings, Arpaio has been their guest of honor. So
Arpaio knows that these people are his supporters. He actually, in the past, has called them, invited them. He's given speeches and invited them to speeches. He's shown up for them. And not only Arpaio, but other locally elected officials, such as Russell Pierce, a legislator from Mesa and the state ledge, who has extensive ties to these groups. So it's really concerning to see elected officials getting connected with these types of groups and to see how unconcerned a lot of the voting populace is by that in this county.
So let's talk a little bit about the voting populace in this county, because we understand from talking to people that Joe Arpaio was elected by a majority. Can you address his popularity here and what needs to change?
Well, he can't be removed at a federal level. He is elected locally. Certainly the federal government can take away a lot of his power, and the federal government can censure him. But it is concerning. He was elected by a majority populace, and a lot of Maricopa County really does want these kinds of tactics. What's interesting is he runs on a tough-on-crime platform, and it's really not supported by the facts. The Goldwater Institute, which is an extremely conservative organization, recently published a report detailing how Arpaio's tactics are not tough on crime, and they've actually resulted in an increase in crime because he's wasting so many resources on these stupid publicity stunts, bringing hundreds of deputies into Guadalupe, a town of 1 square mile, with literally hundreds of cars saturated to arrest people who turn out to be Native American, not Hispanic at all. And in the outlying areas, at the same time, where the Sheriff's Department is supposed to be focusing, the 911 response times are through the roof. In fact, in some areas, the median response time for a 911 call, a priority one call, is 15 minutes, when the county's own standards say that it's supposed to be with 3 to 5 minutes. Priority one call would be, for example, my house is being burglarized and they're still in my home. Or my husband's been shot and the man who shot him is still here. These types of calls, 15 minutes. But the populace here in Maricopa County, what they want is theater. And so, you know, he'll arrest a couple of dishwashers and he'll have this whole parade around it. And he'll have the mobile command unit. And he'll make this big publicity circus. And this is seen as more tough on crime because it includes the humiliation of the people who are arrested, because it includes this whole elaborate political theater that Arpaio has developed, more than what the Phoenix police is doing, which is just going out quietly, going up to the most dangerous criminals, arresting them, throwing them in jail without a big fanfare, without the press conferences, without the swagger. So it's concerning because I think politicians across the country are seeing that this is a tactic that works, that people respond more to this type of publicity stunt and political theater than they do to actual, meaningful professional law enforcement.
You just heard from Jason Odner. Next up, Sylvia Herrera of the Puente Movement.
Arpaio always has a press conference to announce these raids, which are in fact, you know, he's saying he's looking for criminals. Well, what law enforcement announces an undercover operation, you know? And that's why these individuals are supposed to be wearing ski masks. It just doesn't jive. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever, other than people are being harassed and racially profiled and questioned about their status, sort of at the discretion of these individuals that are either posse or deputies in ski masks.
Part of the work that Puente is engaged in and is taking people's testimonies?
Yes, we've collected a number of testimonies as well as other groups. We follow the deputies when they do make the stops. We observe and we tape and we document the situation as it occurs. We talk to the individuals. For instance, if they get stopped sometimes, later on we'll talk to them. And they will say, well, the first thing they asked me was to see my Social Security card. Or they asked me where I was born. Rather than saying, well, the reason why I'm stopping you or being asked for their driver's license. We get testimonies from even U.S. citizens that are detained for several days because they don't sound convincing that they're U.S. citizens, or they don't believe that the ID that they're showing is real. They're constantly questioned by the sheriffs or the deputies to admit that they're from Mexico or that they're not U.S. citizens. Then all of a sudden they're released with no charges. So there's been other people that have, like I mentioned, have an unpaid ticket. There's people that are detained or stopped because of supposedly there's a broken taillight, or it seems like there was a broken taillight, but then there's not a broken taillight. Stops that are unfounded.
You just heard from Sylvia Herrera, and now we're going to hear from Antonio Bustamante, a Phoenix lawyer and immigrant rights advocate, on Circle A Radio.
There's no doubt he's committing racial profiling. He goes out and conducts so-called crime sweeps, and he's going to go out and announce this through very high-profile press releases and press conferences. He's going out and does this for a two-day period on weekends. He's going to ferret out criminals. And he picks areas of the county where he claims there are certain crimes. He started out by claiming there are crimes of loitering, trespassing, and public urination. Well, that's not high-level crime, not that serious. He amasses enormous police resources to only stop people driving cars. How that stops trespassing by foot or loitering or urination, it makes no sense, but the media here doesn't ask that question. It's a crime suppression sweep. And when you pull people over for traffic stops in Arizona, most traffic stops are for civil infractions or violations of the civil traffic code. It's not criminal. Hardly ever is it a crime. Hardly ever are traffic tickets criminal in nature. If they are, they're only misdemeanors. Still not ferreting out serious crime. So what he claims he's doing is an aberration to what he's really doing, and what he's really doing is stopping people who are brown in cars, arresting them under his authority, under agreements with the federal government that he can enforce immigration law. So if you stop cars because they have brown people on the expectation that sometime or a lot of the time you're going to find undocumented people in there because you lean on them and harass them until they admit where they're from, and that's exactly what they do. They don't leave people alone when they decline to answer questions. They're threatened with arrest. They're threatened that their children will be taken away from them. People answer questions, and then they're still arrested, and their children are still taken away from them. It's horrible.
Is there legal recourse against Joe Arpaio?
There are three forms of recourse. One is public opinion, which is against this, which is sorely lacking in this county. And in fact, these types of activities are considered to be just fine. They would be considered to be the most horrible thing under the concepts of civil rights and liberty if they were being perpetrated against the majority. But since they're not, it's only being done against brown people, and they don't matter. So who cares? And the illegals, as the misnomer is used, are thought to be criminals of the first order when entering the country without documentation is a petty offense under federal law. It's a misdemeanor, a petty offense. Equal in severity to driving in Arizona over the speed limit by 20 miles an hour or more, which is also a misdemeanor. Now, for those of us who have done that frequently, as I have, I guess we're all illegals. It's absurd, but that's what's going on here. And I'm not sure if I've answered your question. I started to, but maybe I got off track.
That's okay. So we were talking about what the recourse is, and you say public opinion, but unfortunately the public in Maricopa County is overwhelmingly still supporting this racist.
Yeah, and public opinion that is derived from an influx of people from everywhere else in the country except southern Arizona or the border area. People have a concept of what other parts of the country should be like or are like, but this is Arizona where we have a border, and there's been at least two centuries of respect, not always consistent, but still significant for Mexico and people from across the border. But that is lost with this influx of newcomers who have no idea what this land is about or whose land it used to be. So public opinion is one recourse, and we don't have it. Secondly, is the federal government the most powerful and potent tool against this kind of abuse against the undocumented? It would be the federal government, but we have not had a Justice Department in Washington, D.C. for the last 8 years, and I hope we have a civil rights division in the Justice Department that is a real civil rights division under the new president. Time will tell. but it will take time. We've started to see stirrings of a Justice Department and a Congress, a Judiciary Committee in the House of Representatives that is now becoming concerned, and I hope that that really takes root. The third recourse is litigation. Litigation has been instituted. We have one significant lawsuit that will soon probably go the way of a class action to put a stop to this, but civil litigation takes years. And so by the time one wins a lawsuit against Joe Arpaio and the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office for civil rights abuses based on racial profiling and so on, and the deportation, or rather the arrests of United States citizens who are held for days until they're finally released, brown people who are citizens, and then, oops, they're citizens, not undocumented, to put a stop to that will take years. But that's perhaps the most certain recourse. Although those kinds of lawsuits are very hard to win, it's very difficult to win a civil rights lawsuit, but after a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, they sometimes can be won. I have every reason to think this litigation against Arpaio will be run. But in the meantime, the sheriff continues this. He knows that even if he loses the lawsuit, money will have to be paid, and all he will endure is an order to stop doing this. In the meantime, he's caused so much grief. He has separated so many families. He has arrested so many United States citizens who are brown, just because they are brown. He has ruined the lives of people whose only offense for being undocumented is to commit a petty offense under the criminal law. And in the meantime, he has allowed real criminals to go free or uninvestigated because he's turning enormous taxpayer dollars to focus on the undocumented instead of rapists, murderers, and the serving of 43,000 felony warrants that are his responsibility to serve by finding people for whom the warrants are outstanding. He won't do any of that. That takes real courage, real guts, and real law enforcement, and that kind of professionalism is not in this sheriff's bag of tricks. It's too easy and sweet, and he gets too much applause for going after gardeners, nannies, cooks, farm workers who are undocumented.
You just heard from Antonio Bustamante. Last week, the Department of Justice sent a letter informing Arpaio that he is now under investigation. This follows on the heels of a report detailing racial profiling connected with 287G agreements all over the country. And it is entitled, Local Democracy on Ice, Why State and Local Governments Have No Business in Federal Immigration Law Enforcement, and recommends that the ICE program be terminated. For more information, you can go to www.justicestrategies.org. Again, Jason Odner.
The Justice Strategies report that just came out shows that 287G agreements are a failure. Can you address that as well?
As law enforcement, they're a failure. As politics, they've been a great success. People get very excited when they see brown people being taken away. But they're not working. And this is true not just of 287Gs, but of a lot of the immigration enforcement policies that we're using right now. For example, there is a special division within the Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency that's supposed to take away and hunt down dangerous criminal aliens. And so they'll bust into a house with intelligence that's 5 years old, and poor people, whether they're immigrants or not, move very frequently. And so they'll kick down the door and they'll say, where is Jose? And they'll realize Jose hasn't lived here for 3 years, but there's a family here now, and it's a Hispanic neighborhood, and they'll check papers, and they'll take them. It's not a dangerous criminal alien family. It's just a family of people who committed a misdemeanor by coming across the border without papers. But because they're arrested by that division, they're listed on paper as being another violent, dangerous criminal alien removal, because everyone that that special team takes away has been put down that way. And what we're finding now is that even the numbers have been saying again and again, oh, we'll remove this many dangerous criminal aliens, the vast majority of these people actually were not 287Gs. This agreement was designed to facilitate the removal of dangerous criminal aliens, and this recent report has shown that the majority of them are not. They're people who are being pulled over, often through racial profiling, and they're not what the agreement was ever designed to facilitate.
If the 287G agreement here in Maricopa County is eliminated, what are other threats?
Well, we do advocate for the termination of 287G agreements, not only Maricopa County, but nationwide. because this is the largest 287G agreement and some of the more egregious abuses, I think we're in a position to be able to act and provide some leadership to have these removed nationally. And we should do that, but it won't save us here in Maricopa County because we have an extremely anti-immigrant legislature who is currently working to pass a bill, which I think will pass despite all efforts to the contrary. And this bill will criminalize being an immigrant without papers in the state of Arizona at a state level.
You're listening to Circle A Radio. That was Jason Odner. We're featuring interviews with three immigrant rights organizers in Phoenix, Arizona. The National Campaign to Stop 287G Agreements, ICE Raids, and to Achieve Comprehensive Immigration Reform kicked off in Phoenix on February 27th and 28th as solidarity activists from across the country joined a march to stop hate and to stop Joe Arpaio. Now back to Sylvia Herrera.
Right now, it seems as there is somewhat of a response coming from D.C. There's been national reports that have come out that the 287G is not a good program for the very reasons that we've just discussed. There's a review by Janet Napolitano, which is the Secretary of Homeland Security now. She was a former governor of Arizona. There is that review that's taking place. And also the investigation of Arpaio at the request of the Judiciary Committee of Congress. And we hope that the Department of Justice will also start investigating Arpaio. There's also a tour of cities that Congressman Luis Gutierrez out of Illinois is working on to have the churches participate in and collect information on what is happening to migratory families in their communities. I know that they've been in Atlanta and in San Francisco. They've been in different cities throughout the country, bringing forth the testimonies of families. I think that the focus was stop the raids and stop the division and separation of families. Yesterday evening they were here, and as we've been doing our actions and we've been forcefully taking on the whole 287G agreement, is that now that message is also being put forth by the Congress persons to look at the 287G, not only at the specifically for Arpaio, but for the entire country.
You just heard from Sylvia Herrera, and now we're going to hear from Antonio Bustamante.
What I would request the people in other parts of the country is to send letters to the Department of Homeland Security and demand a stop to the unregulated, unsupervised use of these 287G agreements, which is a section of the law that allows for local police agencies like the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office and several others that have been participants of this program around the country to use its officers to become, in essence, deputized immigration officers or border patrol guards. That if those are going to be used, that they be limited to their intended purpose, which is to fight serious crime, violent crimes, drugs, gangs, things of that nature. And that is not being done. Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is a sub-agency of Homeland Security, allows the rampant, uncontrolled use of these agreements to arrest anybody. And that's not their purpose. It deflects limited and precious law enforcement resources from fighting real crime just to ferret out people of color because they are easy targets. I can understand that law enforcement wants to go after what's easy. We all tend to do what is easy. It's not limited just to law enforcement, but because it's human nature. But that's the reality. Instead of doing with these agreements what is intended, they are being misused to go after people of no consequence, no danger to society. That makes no sense, and people need to contact Homeland Security to tell them to stop doing that. In addition, the Justice Department, the Attorney General, needs to be contacted as well, because the Civil Rights Division has a lot to say about stopping these kinds of abuses, particularly when 287G agreements are used
to conduct racial profiling.
That was Phoenix lawyer Antonio Bustamante. Again, Silvia Herrera of the Puente Movement.
Do you have a message for folks in different parts of the country? Any requests from Arizona or any advice for us here in the Northwest?
Well, we want to have Congress revoke the 287G, and we haven't seen any good come out of that for any community. And also to stop the raids, to have those messages put forth very clearly and strong, and that we appreciate all the support that we've gotten and received from people throughout the country. If people want more information, they could go to our website, Puente, PUENTEAZ.org. That has the information on our Wells Fargo campaign and the connection to Arpaio, Wells Fargo, and the GEO group, which is a corporation that owns private prisons. And that group owns a lot of the detention centers throughout the country and throughout the world, actually. Whatever can be done locally, we appreciate that, you know, because it is from a very local level, but it has to be brought forth on the national scene, that it be given that attention by Congress. So anything that is done locally in communities throughout the country, that those efforts will make a difference, and I appreciate that.
If anything, I would hope that the public understands that we have allowed to go unchallenged for too long terms like illegal or illegal alien. It's such a misuse of the English language. I don't think anywhere in the language it would be condoned to call any person something that is illegal. Illegal is something one does. It is not something one is. Therefore, there cannot be a person who is illegal, nor can there be a person who is an illegal alien or illegal immigrant. The misuse of language is also a misuse of jurisprudence. A human being cannot be illegal for the same reasons. A human being can only do something illegal. The law does not condone the notion that someone can be illegal, especially in a country that is supposed to be the land of the free and the home of the brave, and especially given the language of our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence. It's absurd. So because we've allowed the use of illegal alien, or worse, the use of illegal to identify an undocumented person, people think they are really, really bad people. And I've tried to explain a moment ago that it's a misdemeanor to come into the country, a petty offense. I would ask that people understand that the undocumented are folks who come here to survive, but that doesn't impress very many people. But what ought to impress people is an honesty that were it not for the undocumented, we would not have food on our tables, because it is almost singularly the undocumented that pick our crops and put food on our table. It is, especially in this part of the country, but almost everywhere in the country, the undocumented who bus our tables, who are in the kitchens cooking our food, whether it be Chinese or Indian or Asian or any other kind of food, it is brown people, many of whom are not here with authorization. It is the brown people who are the laborers who contributed mightily to build the homes we all live in, to put up the edifices that are the office buildings in which we work on a daily basis. They are the people who take care of our children. They are the nannies. They are the gardeners. They are the people who landscape our homes and manicure our lawns. They are the people who make our society go round and round economically. And then we treat them like garbage and kick them in the head without so much as an acknowledgement for the vast and unheralded contributions they have made to all of us. That is so unfair and so antithetical to concepts of fairness upon which this country was founded. I can understand folks wanting individuals to come here legally, but when the system really is one where everything has been done for that not to be the case, I think we need to open our eyes and understand that, and understand what we've gotten out of it. So that those who have been brought here, who have been lured here as a result of that system, there should be an amnesty for them. And if you're going to change the rules of the game, fine, but with notice. And don't start deporting and arresting people who have done so much to make our lives real pretty.
The fight's not over. It's a long way from over, and Arpaio is still in power. He's still got his 287G agreements, and it would certainly be premature to declare victory at this point. But the tides are turning, and it's turning not because some big national organization with a lot of money stood up to him, not because the politicians took the initiative to stand up to him, but because a bunch of activists, broke college students, ordinary people on the street, got together, sent out text messages when they heard that this was going on to all their friends, showed up with the video cameras or disposable cameras, and just started doing what they could and organized. And, you know, it's not over yet, but this works. These grassroots tactics do work. They don't work quickly, and sometimes it feels like you're not getting anywhere, but you got to hold your ground because you can't trust the politicians to do it unless you make them.
Thank you to our guests, Silvia Herrera, Antonio Bustamante, and Jason Odner. More information available on the web at www.puenteaz.org. PUENTEAZ.org and www.ndlon.org. That's the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, ndlon.org. If you would like to get involved in local organizing to terminate 287Gs, stop the ICE raids, and support a just and comprehensive immigration reform, join us at VOS 1131 Southeast Oak on Thursday, March 19th at 7 p.m. for an organizing meeting. You can also contact the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee at 503-236-7916 for more information and to get involved. Circle A Radio is broadcast every first and third Wednesday from 6 till 7 p.m. on KBOO 90.7 in Portland. Thanks for listening.